You're listening to State of the Human, the radio show of the Stanford Storytelling Project, and this week we're investigating how we learn to lie. When we're kids, we often learn about lying and about how to lie indirectly, by figuring out that a story we have been told for years, like the story of Santa Claus, is a bunch of hooey. Or by watching those around us say they feel one thing while they clearly feel something else. But sometimes we learn to lie in a much more direct way. Our parents ask us to lie. Dana Kletter was only 7 years old when she found herself in a situation where she needed to learn how to lie, and to lie well. It was a matter of survival. But like any little girl, she also felt a big pressure to tell the truth, no matter how dangerous that may be.
In 1966, my father and his brother owned Eastern Freightways, a large trucking company that was quite successful. And we lived very comfortably and, in fact, were wealthy. And had a big house in Buffalo, New York, with a swimming pool in the backyard and a nanny to keep the children in order. And my father, of course, took care of his parents. And we lived a very nice life. My father called it the years of fancy living.
This is Dana Kletter talking. She's a Stegner Fellow here at Stanford. In the last year of fancy living, Dana was a 7-year-old kid. She lived in a big house in upstate New York with her mother, her 3 siblings, her 2 grandparents, and her dad, who happened to be wanted by federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies. See, Dana's father routinely had to deal with partners who were involved in organized crime. He was in the garment trucking industry. If you were in the trucking business in the 60s, you had to deal with organized crime. This wasn't a problem until Dana's uncle, her father's business partner, died. Her father, George Kletter, was left responsible for his company's not entirely legal business connections.
One day, my mother opened the door, and there were federal agents and sheriffs waiting there, and they came in and searched our whole house, and then they took anything that was deemed extraneous to our existence. And it was all removed from our house. They opened up the break front in our dining room, and that's where the Passover dishes were, and they started wrapping them up. And then they cut the chandelier down from where it was, the chain over the dining room table. There was some guy walking with this giant chandelier just wandering around, which is a really odd looking thing. My mother immediately regressed in time. I mean, she lost it. She hit hysterical at about the speed of sound. My mother was, you know, crying and screaming. Everyone else was frozen. I mean, I remember, like, crying, but I was crying, like, because my mother was crying. And so, like, when you're a little kid, if your mother cries, or anyone cries, you automatically cry. Just like when someone throws up in the school cafeteria, everyone does. My mother, who is a survivor of the Holocaust and was in a concentration camp, is a very delicate woman, and any sort of trauma will kind of reel her right back to this most traumatic moment. And so it must have been a complete flashback for her, because this is exactly, in some way, what happened to her in 1940, whatever it was. So yeah, we just, that, you know, life just changed overnight.
Less than a year later, the Kletter family was on the run. Agents, federal agents, IRS agents, even local police, were all looking for Dana's father because of his ties to organized crime. To keep a low profile, the Clutter family lived in a series of cheap motels. Finally, someone stepped in to help Dana's mother find a house in New York. But that didn't mean they were out of danger. Law enforcement agents still wanted Dana's father, and they started calling, coming to the house, knocking on the door to see if he was around. If they found him, he could go to prison, and that meant the whole family, mom, siblings, grandparents, Dana, would lose their only provider. So the family began taking precautions to make sure that wouldn't happen.
My parents had an elaborate system for sneaking my father back into our house.
They came up with a system after the first time they brought Dana's father home.
My mother, she woke us up, and, you know, we'd been put to bed in our jammies, and she led us all out to the car, and she told us, you know, we're going to meet Daddy. And, of course, we were, like, excited and at the same time terrified, because we thought, well, what does that mean? If we see my father, is everyone going to see my father? So my father is waiting in between two cars, slouching there, smoking cigarettes, waiting for my mother to show up. And, you know, we just cruised through long-term parking, just through all the aisles, until my father kind of stepped out. And he dressed like a gangster. He had, like, a fedora. He always wore a fedora, and he had a big coat on. And we opened the door, and he, instead of, like, getting into the car like an adult, he just crouched down and got onto the floor of the car. I remember picking my feet up and, like, looking down there. And there was no, after that, like, the door was shut, and my mother just took off.
The family gets home and closes the blinds. Then Dana's father sits the kids down for a talk.
My father, he was very matter-of-fact. He just said, you know, Daddy's in trouble. It's not his fault, which is not exactly true. When the phone rings, you know, it's important that you don't tell anyone that I'm here. It's important that you never tell anyone that I ever come home, if I ever come home. It's important to not tell your teacher, not to tell your friends at school. Then this was just delivered to us, you know. But I think because it was so calmly done, it was a relief to have my father just give us these instructions, to give us, like, a, you know, a code. This is the code. This is how you behave. This is how we keep things safe. You know, we were harboring a fugitive. Our neighborhood was filled with kids, and everyone rode their bikes, and, you know, on the weekends, everybody, like, went to the pool or had snowball fights or whatever, and on weekends, we simply couldn't do that because we had to disappear. But also, we just simply had to pretend that we were okay, and that life was normal, and that nothing odd was happening at our house. And so it was, like, a much bigger lie, and it was a kind of lie that we had to inhabit, the way you inhabit a house.
Dana and her siblings, all still younger than 10, became the guardians of the house. They became the most important line of defense between their father and law enforcement. They were the ones who answered the door when his pursuers came knocking.
They knew that they would have to send us to the door, because a child standing there, a 7-8-year-old, the police don't think that you're going to lie. They trust that you will act in the way that you've been taught to act in public school. So, you know, we were always sent to the door, even though we were little kids, because it just was more credible. Our lies were more credible. I think we did all look fairly angelic, actually. Right? Because we had, like, ringlets, blonde ringlets. And my twin sister and I were always dressed in matching clothes. you just had to kind of like erase your face, like erase your own persona in a way, and assume like the guise of a younger child. Part of that was to have this like kind of more higher pitched voice. My twin sister and I were very good at this. You would just kind of look breathlessly at them, eyes widened, you know, is your daddy home? No. Do you know where your daddy is? I don't know. He's not here. When will he be home? I don't know. Does he ever come home? No. Do you ever go to see your father? No. We learned that the best lie is a simple lie, so don't elaborate. Act as if you did not know anything and as if they couldn't get any information out of you, so you didn't engage, actually, with these guys who, you know, were just kind of looking for a vulnerability.
For a while, all went according to plan. Dana's dad disappeared all week, and on the weekends, he came home. They closed the curtains, and he hid himself indoors. The kids answered the phone and the door, but they didn't answer questions. And it worked. Dana kept the secret. And then one day, she was playing in the driveway, and a sheriff approached her.
And he was a very tall man, and he was a sheriff, so he had a big round hat like Smokey the Bear, and he looked a little like Smokey the Bear, and he had this big mustache. So, you know, he got down sort of on his haunches, and I was like probably, you know, 3 feet tall, so he just made himself as small as possible. And he had a friendly face, so I didn't want to lie. He said, "Where's your daddy?" And I said, "He's not here." And I knew what I was supposed to say, but he was so nice and he looked so much like Smokey the Bear that I felt compelled to say at least something to appease him. So I said, "He might come home, maybe Friday." And once I said that, he started sort of pressing a little further and almost like an interrogation. Even his face, his whole countenance changed completely. And then his voice got kind of sharper and louder. And he said, "When is your father coming home? How do you know he's coming home? What time do you think he'll be home?" And then I just completely backed off. And I did what I always do when I'm terrified, or what I did when I was a child, which was to throw up, and which I did right on his shoes, on his very shiny, shiny black policeman's shoes. And then I ran into the house and hid in a closet. And I was so ashamed that I hadn't lied, and that I had given in to like this urge to, I think maybe it was even just to be a regular kid. I was afraid because I knew what I was supposed to do, because telling the truth at that point had so much potential for endangering all of us, that I just was so horrified that I told a partial truth. It was nice and dark in the closet, and it was just filled with like nice woolen coats and my father's great coat, which was this like, cashmere old coat that I was really fond of. And I thought, well, I'll just live here. One of my sisters had seen that I spoke to the policeman a little too long, and she suspected that I had told him the truth. So my mother walked in the front door, and they ran down the stairs, and they were terrified, and I was just hauled out of the closet. And my mother didn't, like, hit me or anything. Her punishment for my telling the truth was to demonstrate to me how distressed she was, and so she wept and screamed and sort of like, you know, banged on the walls and like, what are the children doing? What have they done? What has Dana done? She's ruined our lives. And so it reinforced my belief that that the truth was way too dangerous.
¶¶
And so that is the day that I learned the meaning of the word collaborator, which is, in my mother's sort of worldview, a woman who had been hunted by Nazis, a person who tells the truth to people who are bad and will cause death and mayhem. So, who wants to be a collaborator? And this is also kind of connected to my mother's life, because my mother's father did not survive the war. And she saw very bad things happen to him. And she told us that. So our fear for our father was tremendous.
Dana's grandfather served in World War I. He spoke German and taught his family to speak German, even though they were Hungarian. He even had a visa to see the World's Fair, which would have gotten him out of Hungary and safely into the United States. But he didn't believe he needed to save himself. German culture held a great deal of resonance for him, and he strongly believed that this country would not betray him. Dana's mother last saw him on the selection platform, and he died in a concentration camp. Nothing like this ever happened to Dana's father. And over time, the threat to him from investigators and the mob passed. But for a family that had lived through the Holocaust, that had lost a father once before, it was difficult to let go of the peril they felt and the lying that seemed so necessary.
There was always this sort of sense that, I should trust these people. I've been told to trust these people, but I know that I can't. Maybe it didn't feel like we were doing something so terribly bad because we knew what had happened to my grandfather. My father continued to do imprudent things, but it never felt as obviously as immediate as it did when there's a guy cutting your chandelier off the ceiling. We consistently remained fearful and worried about my father, and believed that my father was in danger from anything, like not necessarily from the cops, but from cigarettes, from eating too many scones, from driving too fast, all the things that he did. We understood that it was incumbent upon us to deflect attention and to protect my father. So my father would step into the street and, my sister and I would just fall to the ground, and he'd be like, "What? The light's red. It's time to cross the street." But if my father had gone to jail, then I don't know what would have happened to us, actually. And had we lost that house, it would have been a terrible disaster. The most important thing was allegiance to our family. And the most, most important thing was to protect my father.
Dana Kletter is a writer, musician, and current Stegner Fellow at Stanford. Her story was produced by Ponce Rutsch, a senior majoring in biology.